You are listening to The Scope at the on the floor of the AAMC Learn, Serve, Lead 2022 conference, where we are having conversations with the, you know, movers and shakers in academic medicine who are looking to kind of change the way we do things from the ground up. And today we're going to be having a couple of people on to kind of talk to us about how we can kind of maybe change the health of the nation if we change the way we educate in medicine. And the idea that if we can expand access to people who have typically not had it, the way we do it is by reaching them where they are already at. To discuss this, we are joined by Dr. Pedro Greer. He is the Dean of the Roseman University College of Medicine, as well as Dr. Lou Brewster, who is the Senior Executive Dean for Community Health Innovation at Roseman University College of Medicine, as well as Dr. Jose Rodriguez, who will be leading the conversation today, who is the Associate Vice President of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion for University of Utah Health. So let's start with you, Dr. Rodriguez. How do we change the health of the nation by changing medical education?
Well, I am very lucky to be here with Dr. Greer and Dr. Brewster. All three of us lived in Miami, and they were previously, before being at Roseman, they were at FIU College of Medicine. And so what I'd like to hear about is some of the stuff that you're doing at Roseman and the stuff that you did in Miami to kind of address this issue of bringing health to the people.
Well, actually, let me start off. The architect of what we're going to be talking about is Dr. Lou Brewster. And the question that was asked was, how do we get to the poorest patient before they show up at the clinic? And so that was put in front of us. And the answer to something like that does not come from MDs. It comes from a collection of individuals that actually understand community and understand society. We understand science and disease, but we need individuals that actually, this is where not only they're trained, but where their mission lies. And with that, I'm going to stop talking and I'm going to hand it over to Lou.
Well, I would say that, you know, one of the big things is that we do need MDs. We need MDs to change the definition of what is leadership in medicine. And that means, like Dr. Greer was saying, that we have to empower all members of the interprofessional team to play a valuable role in addressing some of the change that's needed. The reality is that medicine and health have become a lot more social and a lot more reliant on the activities and the context that people live in every day. And those are things that sadly are outside of the purview and the expertise many times of clinicians. That does not mean that clinicians are marginalized in that process. It just means that there's others that they can draw expertise from. No different than their reliance on data analytics and data scientists or individuals who have expertise in nursing or any other skill set needed. But at the core of it is reducing the distance between the patient and their provider. When you get closer to the people that you are supposed to serve, exciting things, great things, and spectacular things occur. And so by having physicians as their training visit the homes of the individuals that they're caring for, you now have a shared existence with them, even for a brief time. If they have a infestation in their home, you now are in that infestation. If they have a leaky roof, the water is now dripping on your head as well. And so you have a heightened motivation to do something about it when you know that you have to go back to that home in a month's time. And so that's really what Joe kind of challenged all of us to do, was to just try to get medical students to learn empathy through lived experiences.
And let me just add something on there too. This is going up against a established academic medicine, which, just to put it very clearly, you know, structurally, we are racist, we are sexist, we are xenophobic, and we are elitist. The average income of an American medical student's family in 2020 was 2 to 3 times that of the national average. But on graduation, we are required to take care of an entire population without really understanding it. And one of the most amazing things that Lou has done, because when we take the student into the household, you change the power differential. You're no longer coming to the ivory tower. You're entering somebody's home. And Lou made a requirement that the student, the medical student, was never allowed to ask, how do you feel? The question had to be, what is your most urgent need? And so all of a sudden, the student now understands the reality. The student then understands also that the doctor is not always the king or the queen. the doctor sometimes has to be just a member of the team. And sometimes probably the member that can contribute the least. And you have to admit that. And that's the truth.
That's a humble approach to care.
And that's wonderful. Now, if I remember correctly, this program that you guys ran wasn't just once a month for 1 year.
No.
It was for
all four years. And it could be, it was a minimum of one visit per month. We had some students who were doing visits multiple times a month. But also keep in mind, we had a full-time team of lay health workers who were recruiting, supporting the students along the way. So even when visits weren't being performed by the students, we had enough commitment to the community to hire a team that quite honestly has never really had a role in medical education to manage and support the students when they are taking exams and doing the things that students have to do, that the household is not left in a lurch. They actually still have support. They still have someone to contact them. And the beauty of it is that we preferentially hired individuals from the community that we were doing home visits in. And we looked for individuals who didn't have a college degree. Because the reality is this, everything that we did, we embedded this same philosophy in. We didn't want to be the medical school that was good at helping students and good at creating good experiences for students, but then neglecting and avoiding the societal ills that were broadly impacting the work that we were doing. So we go in these communities, people need jobs. So why not hire them? People, oftentimes medical schools don't even purchase. Their procurement excludes these communities. They have things to sell. We would buy from those communities. We would take individuals who didn't have a college degree, bring them in, and get them college degrees.
Over half of those ended up with college degrees. One, by the way, is now getting her PhD in policy analysis at the RAND Corporation.
And these are community health workers you're talking about. These are
community health workers, but we didn't call them community health workers, just to tell you how the system is so screwed up. Because if we call them community health workers without the certification from the state, then they wouldn't be recognized. So we purposefully called them outreach workers, neglected to do the outreach training. But you know what? That was a benefit. They did us a favor because by creating our own training modules, we were able to put people on a path. Because what we learned was the retention for community health workers and other programs was terrible. But we kept our people. Why? Because we didn't train them with the expectation that they were going to do this job the rest of their lives. We gave them transferable skills, got them degrees so that they can enjoy and pursue the careers they wanted to pursue. You learn by serving, and then you go on and you enjoy the prosperity that everyone else has.
And the other lesson that became very important is called social accountability. To be responsible for what is going on in your community. It's by looking at it not from how do I train my medical student, but how do I prepare the future physician to really serve our country and improve the health of our nation. For example, if it was just the student, we wouldn't care about the community. The community sees that becomes vitally important. And, you know, some of the students upon graduation, the saddest part was they had to leave their family. But the other aspect of from a medical education perspective, what other course gives you 4 years of longitudinal care of the same household, which is what you're going to be doing in a true medical practice? And, you know, I'm a gastroenterologist, hepatologist, and students are always shocked that when they ask, what is your most urgent need? Medical never comes up.
And interesting.
I've been in practice, you know, over 45 years. And as a gastroenterologist asking the question, nobody has ever said colonoscopy is their most urgent need. And it is.
Because at the end of the day, people want to address their basic needs first.
Absolutely.
I want to feed my family first, right? And we've all know the story of people who they'll give up everything to make sure their children are fed.
Absolutely.
They will limp into an emergency department after they fed their family. And so what we did was we made a conscious effort to not go to healthcare providers to recruit households. We went to non-health providing nonprofits that were seeing these individuals first, trained them on how to identify them, and then refer them to us. So we had, and all of this, the last number I saw to date, we've serviced 14,000 households in South Florida. Okay? 14,000 uninsured, low-income households. And we're not even there anymore. So now we're bringing this to Southern Nevada, to Las Vegas, implementing this. We've already started it. In South Florida, it was called Neighborhood Help. In Las Vegas, we call it Genesis.
And we've taken it a step further. Tell them about the cars.
Oh, it's incredible. So now, always being responsive, the first intervention is always right outside our office door. So one of the things that Dr. Greer gave us the ability to do was to purchase electric vehicles for our staff. And that's because I didn't want the burden of on their cars. Right. I didn't want you to have to own a vehicle to work for me. Right. And so now you can go and serve your community, work for us and drive the vehicles that we have. But the second part to that is that low income communities are always the last to receive innovation. I'm amazed that there were no electric vehicle charges in these communities before we got there. But now since we're doing it, we can basically say, if you want these services in your community, then you got to put charges because my cars need to be charged so that we can continue to do the work. So now there's a back-end motivation or incentive to bring technology to these communities. The next element, our goal is to create what's called Genesis Zones, six of them. Six Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi enabled areas that, yes, every household that is in our area will have free Wi-Fi and being able to provide care digitally and offline, you know, high touch services in their home.
This is a spectacular revolution.
And not only that, what comes out really important for the students, they do a lot of reflective writings and narrative writings. Now, why does that become important? Because if we're training the future workforce to be leaders, if they can't tell a story, they cannot make a change.
Exactly. Exactly. Because what does Joe tell me? Facts tell, stories sell.
All right. Can I steal that? Because I'm putting that in my leadership.
No, Joe told me that all the time. Facts tell, stories sell.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we can call it, dress it up all we want, but you have to sell healthcare to individuals in this day and age. There's too many competing narratives. There's too many competing priorities. You have to sell it. You have to find a way to make people do something they don't want to do and love it. That's true medical leadership, finding a way to get them to do something they don't want to do and love. We have a mascot for Genesis. It's called the Apple Cone. And the reason we have it is that people want ice cream, but we need them to have apples. So we have an actual design of an apple cone. I'll send it to you. It's an apple on top of an ice cream cone. And that's to remind the staff, remind the community that we're going to meet you where you are. I know you want ice cream, but we want you to have apples. So how do we find a middle ground?
And we told them we have enough patients for the dental school.
what an incredible story. You know, this is the kind of thing that needs to happen everywhere. And
exactly.
Bringing this to the community, it's revolutionary what you guys have done in both places that you've been. Having a medical student have one class for 4 years is miraculous to begin with. Then to have them have a relationship with families for 4 years, there are people who won't stay in the same job for 4 years in their entire career. And you've given them a gift for their entire career.
Can I give you some retention rates? Can I give you some retention rates?
Please share.
So in South Florida, our 12-month retention rate for households was 83%.
Oh my
our
gosh.
24-month, our 24-month retention rate was 77%. That's with no incentives. For anyone, not the organizations, not the families, no one. Money exchanged anywhere in that system.
Let me tell you how successful. We were in all parts of South Florida, south to north, but in the northern part of the county where we were there, I think it was either Opa-locka or Miami Gardens, we took care of a family. The family wanted to know if we could take care of their family that was in Homestead. We explained we were not in Homestead. The next visit, they had the family from Homestead move into their house. So that we could take care of them. I mean, that's how successful it was.
I know I'm the layperson here hopping in, but like at the scope, we've done 2,000, 3,000 interviews. I've edited almost all of them. And I hear about results that people like get awards for and stand up and clap and they have full funding. Say that one more time. The retention rate of these participants.
So the retention rate of a population of low income, undocumented oftentimes, and all uninsured, was for 12 months, 83%, 24 months, 77%.
And the other thing that becomes very important is because we're putting students in these communities and in these households, they learn, and also because of the mentorship of the faculty, the virtues that we don't have in medicine, humility, empathy, compassion. These are the type of things that are really, really missing. You know, the if you look up the definition of wisdom, humility is the first thing that comes up. So apparently there's not a lot of wise people in my profession. So it becomes important that we bring these out and we point these out and we say we need to change our structural way of doing medicine, not just the reasons I had outlined, but also because it becomes a very toxic environment. I mean, I'm a physician. I've been a physician my entire professional life. It's about me and climbing and how many titles I have, you know, whereas it's supposed to be, we're here about service. We're supposed to improve the health of individuals. And as a medical school and as an educator, it becomes our responsibility to not just to produce a future workforce, but to improve the health of the community that we're working in, because things become very regional.
Absolutely.
But the most important aspect of all this is that we go into these communities and we build trust. Why is that important? Let's just look at COVID.
Oh my gosh.
Where the black and brown communities sacrifice illness and death more so than anybody else. And why would they trust us? And everybody is just saying how incredible this telemedicine is. You know, this is great technology. Well, that was originally developed for rural and very poor communities. What happened during COVID? Well, since we hadn't allowed them into the health system, they had no physician or nurse.
Mm-hmm.
So at telemedicine, you have a patient on one end and a health professional at the other. Well, guess what? Only the insured got to take advantage of telemedicine.
Only the people who already had access.
You're right.
Absolutely right. But what a great story. I'm delighted that you guys are in Las Vegas. Las Vegas is only 5.5 hours away from Salt Lake. So I hope we can get you up to visit us in Salt Lake City.
Absolutely.
As we try to make things happen the way you have. This is really a miraculous change in how we see medicine. And what you were sharing, Dr. Greer and Dr. Brewster, we believe that. Not just the entire physician corps or the faculty. I think that we believe that in our deepest personal convictions. But what happens is the pressures on the outside push into that, how many titles can I have? And how much work am I going to do in administration and these things, when what really matters is fixing the problems for the least of us.
Yeah, so we have to place impact over success.
Absolutely.
You know, I meet students all the time and they tell me, you know, that something was successful because they received an award or they got an acknowledgement. Well, that's great, but what did you change? What did you impact? And so a lot of you know, I can't get off without underscoring the value of a dean like Joe Greer, right? You know, all the other deans have the same opportunity to do what he's doing.
That's true.
We can never lose sight of that, right? Everybody has the opportunity to do this. They all have the opportunity to mobilize the team that he did, but they did not, okay? And so my sense is, and in the sense of many who have worked for him, is that he basically is putting his career on the line for each and every household we go into. And so he should be commended for that. And when you look at it in the long term, no matter what happens, there'll be a number of young people who come through the programs who can now never say that it can't be done.
That's right.
That's the most powerful piece of this whole thing.
And when they see what we're doing, they can also say, maybe I can do it better.
Oh, beautiful.
And you know, we're producing that future workforce. And Lou and I have the advantage of going to Catholic school, so we learned very, very early that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is for permission.
Exactly. And all that time in the principal's office and talking to Brother Paul really does pay off at the end.
You had a Brother Paul too?
Of course. Who didn't have a Brother Paul?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, at that.
Everybody has a Brother Paul, and I'm sure that Brother Paul is somewhere probably talking to my son.
That's right, exactly.
telling him, I'm worried about you.
How many times have we heard that?
That's right. How many windows have I cleaned at the high school?
Exactly. Oh my gosh. Well, this has been just completely inspiring. Thank you for your absolutely spectacular work and for your wonderful presentation of it. And I am looking forward to meeting more with you
as time
goes on at the University of Utah
Health.
Come
to the school. Come see us.
That's right.
Oh, I go to Vegas all the time.
Yeah, come see us. Come see us.
And by the way, thank you for the work you're doing.
Oh.
Because that is, I think, essential for improving the health of this country. It is essential. And the more we diversify medical school, the better our profession becomes. Period. There's no question about it. We've seen it in business.
Of course.
We've seen it in everything. I mean, there's no reason not to. And we also have to really consider and relook at what are pre-med requirements.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, how great would it be to have a student that understands the world and not just science, and then can apply science to that world, understands cultures, understands how to be tolerant and acceptant. And, you know, it has to come from the top down. I think we have the most diverse senior faculty that you're going
to
find in this country.
That's wonderful.
And diverse, not just in race, ethnicity, and gender, but diverse in your past education.
Oh, wow.
So it's not, MDs aren't going to resolve this problem because we're not trained for it.
Tell them who created Uber. Who created
Amazon? It wasn't a cab driver that created Uber. It was not a retailer that created Amazon.
That's true.
Unless you bring ideas from the outside and say, and the first question we have to ask as medical educators is, what are we doing wrong to get us to this point? Not what did they do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we change our behavior and what we do?
Absolutely. I think introspection is key to changing how we do business. But honestly, this has been one of the best conversations I've ever had. I look forward to going there, and I look forward to seeing you guys up in Utah.
Thank you.
Come on down, because we want to change what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. We want it to be what happens in Vegas the world knows.
Absolutely. At least, at the very least.
It's not because of iPhones.
Okay, you got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, we are The Scope. We are here at the AAMC Learn, Serve, Lead 2022 conference and having conversations about how we can change medicine from the ground up. Dr. Greer, Dr. Brewster, and Dr. Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining us here on the exhibit floor to have this conversation. If you are listening right now and you love this conversation, would like to hear more, we have plenty that we've gotten here at the event. You can hear those at uofuhealth.org/AAMC22. And if you're interested in any other health-related podcasts, talk shows, basic information, you can also hear more of me at thescoperadio.com.